Hey everyone, welcome back to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. Today I'm so excited to get to talk to Grammy-nominated vocalist Sarah Gazarek about her new female supergroup, Sage, and the Grammy nomination for Desert Song. Such an amazing vocalist, such a great talent, all the way from LA. Please help me welcome Sarah Gazarek.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you perfectly. Good. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, perfect. So let's get into it. I love the song, Desert Song.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to hear from your perspective and chat a little bit more about this all-female vocal supergroup. And hopefully I pronounce this correctly. It's Sage, correct?
Yeah, it kind of rhymes with beige.
Okay. And your Grammy nomination for the song, Desert Song. And so how did this group of talented ladies, you, Amanda Taylor, Janae Kendrick, and Aaron Bintelich, come together and kind of create that group and this song specifically?
Yeah, well, I'm sure like most genres, you know, like especially at least in the jazz genre, it's such a tight-knit community because it isn't necessarily, you know, what we hear on like top 40 radio, Billboard Hot 100. So we all know each other for the most part. And I was a guest for this jazz festival invitational thing that Amanda Taylor's vocal group was hosting. And I just fell in love with her musically and personally. And, you know, as a solo jazz artist, never imagined that I'd want to venture off into an ensemble, but I just loved Amanda so much. And so, you know, ran up to her after the concert and was like, could we ever work together? And she's like, are you kidding me? So I knew Aaron Bentledge, and so did Amanda, from work that they had done together. And, I was really good friends with Janae Kendrick. She's kind of like this, you know, little well-known, but like well-kept secret in the Pacific Northwest. She's like hiding up there, teaching, doing incredible work. And was a great friend of mine and, you know, definitely similar sensibilities. And so we kind of like talked about it. And a friend of mine had a property out in Palm Springs and we, you know, just decided to have a retreat together to see what it might feel like to hang and make music together. And that was when we actually wrote Desert Song. That was the first 3 days that we'd ever all been in the same space together and wanted to just kind of celebrate the freedom and beauty of finally turning towards an all-female collaborator, which was something none of us had ever done. And that was ultimately what launched the ensemble and launched Desert Song. And here we are less than a year later.
That is a quick turnaround to go from the incubation stage and forming into a Grammy nom so quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
Now you were previously nominated for a Grammy as well for your album Thirsty Ghost. So what was the difference kind of when you were doing your solo projects and that Grammy nom versus doing this kind of supergroup combination of different personalities and artists?
Yeah, well, you know, Thirsty Ghost was like my baby, my 5-year, like, tell-all autobiography via an album. And that was a really different journey, more than anything, just because it was like my heart and soul, you know? And this time, it's just as special. It's just super different, you know, because these are some of my best friends and my favorite musicians. And so it's a different experience to experience something kind of in like a vacuum, you know, it was like just me and just my nomination. And this time it really feels like I'm celebrating other people and kind of like this union that we have as a collaborative unit. And also I've been working on my solo career for like 15 years, you know? And so it didn't feel like something that came out of the blue. Whereas with Sage, it's like, you know, we all love each other, but really have not been doing this for very long as a group. And so it was really shocking to kind of like watch the nominees announced and realize that, you know, we were among them, even though we don't even have an album out, let alone, you know, a long history of creating and releasing music. It was kind of more of an honor in that regard, just because we've never released anything. Like, it's one of two songs on Spotify. So it was a little bit shocking to kind of see how the world had responded, to say the least.
Yeah, that's always nice to give stuff out. I think if anything, having one or two songs out gives a proof of concept. They can kind of take it from the idea stage and kind of understand where you're going. But it also still leaves a lot of room for growth and the potential, you know, the best is yet to come. Even though you're already getting nominations, there's still much more that you guys can do with it. And we look forward to hearing maybe a full length soon.
Yeah, I hope so.
And so so let's talk about your storied 15-year career. And so you're born originally in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle, but you moved to L.A. and you attended Thornton School at USC, and you now teach, actually, at USC.
Yes.
And so when you were in school, you were taught by teachers including Carmen Bradford and John Clayton, Tierney Sutton, you know, all super jazz giants. Clayton actually produced your first album, Yours, which was critically and commercially a success, top 10 Billboard, the traditional jazz charts, as well as a top download for iTunes internationally. And Clayton then also did your follow-up second album, Return to You. So how did you initially get into jazz and the jazz idiom starting out in Seattle? And then how did being taught by these giants kind of shape you? And then how did you grow in your artistry, looking back and then now fast forwarding to present day?
Yeah, well, you know, for those who are kind of aware of like pre-collegiate jazz education scene, there's something super weird going on in Seattle. There's like these young baby giants that kind of come out of the high school programs there. And it's kind of like a Houston or like a New York City where it's a, you know, for some reason, I mean, New York kind of makes sense, but like Houston and Seattle are these strange outliers. So I grew up in a school that had a pretty phenomenal jazz program and fell in love with it there. And, you know, remember going to different jazz festivals and interacting with like Ray Brown and Wynton Marsalis and all of these really big jazz greats and realizing that jazz is an art form that really prides itself on authenticity and that you're meant to be yourself when you're communicating and sharing this art form, which was totally new to me as somebody that kind of came up in the theater world and, you know, the idea of like characters and all this stuff. And so I was really taken more than anything with that idea that like, I'm allowed to be myself and the audience wants me to, was really thrilling for me to discover as a young person. And then when I went down to USC, you know, I was a really small fish in a big pond. And so it was a lot of learning and a lot of like hustling to make fill in the blanks of a lot of the things that I didn't know about music and music education and just the art form in general. And so it was a really challenging period, but a lot of hard work went into that time in my life. And then shortly before graduation, ended up applying for some student music awards and was touring and signed a record contract before I had graduated. And I feel like the thing that I learned the most when I was at USC ultimately it was like a lot of conversations with John Clayton. I'm grateful that he was a mentor of mine, and I'm realizing now what a gift that is to have had his perspective on some of these things. But when I was auditioning, you know, to be considered as an artist for like Blue Note and Verve and Sony, John was like, you know, there are people who are worthy of this as well, but that doesn't mean that you're not. And so you just kind of have to get ready, you know, like whether or not you are ready is not up to you to decide. That's up to them to decide. And if they want to sign you, you know, you just have to kind of like make it happen, you know, which was a surprising to have an educator who was as supportive of me at that time in my life. That wasn't something that I was accustomed to, but, you know, very grateful to have had John in my corner as I was kind of navigating that stuff, for sure, to say the least.
Sure. So then as you talk about some of those awards, you were Outstanding Jazz Vocalist by the Ella Fitzgerald Foundation, Best Collegiate Vocalist by Downbeat Magazine. And you're held as an artist that may well turn out to be the next important jazz singer by the LA Times. And so how does it feel to kind of, even at a young age or any age, get such critical and commercial music recognition?
You know, similarly, I am grateful to have had John's guidance, John Clayton's guidance at that time, because I think when you're a young person and you're getting ultimately like receiving positive feedback, it can be really thrilling. But John was really great at kind of keeping me grounded as some of these things were coming in. You know, he was the first person ultimately to just say, listen, this is really great that you're receiving some of these things, but recognize that at the end of the day, this is just currency, you know, and a good review doesn't necessarily mean that you have more value. Just in the same way that a bad review doesn't mean that you have less value. You know, it's really just one person who has been given this opportunity and this gift of being the voice of a publication. And fortunately, if you, you know, if you were to, I don't know, receive a good review, you get to now put that in your bio that New York Times says that, that you're the next big thing. But if for some reason you don't get a good review, that doesn't mean you should quit. That just means that this person, for whatever reason, wasn't feeling your stuff. But that doesn't mean that, that your stuff isn't valuable. And that was really beautiful because it allowed me the opportunity to process things as just that, you know, that it wasn't that like, oh my gosh, I'm so incredible. The LA Times thinks that I'm the next big jazz singer. It's like, well, this one writer on this one night was vibing with the performance that I had. And now I get to put that in a bio, but that doesn't necessarily mean that like I'm the next big thing in jazz, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, you still have to pay your dues and put the work in and make the recordings and stuff like that. Right. But I think that it's just an interesting time. So I wanted to talk in the liner notes for Blossom and Bee, you cited the influence of Blossom Dearie, which I can most certainly hear as a vocalist. But who are your musical influences? Who do you look to for inspiration? And I know there's like, you know, the go-tos of Ella and Billy and Sarah Vaughan, things like that. But I would love to hear not only just the really well-known, but even maybe some obscure people that maybe our listeners would want to hear that aren't necessarily the top of mind all the time.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I think most people start with the bigger artists. Like you said, the Billys and the Ellas. And Ella was definitely my first love, to say the least. She was the one who introduced me to this genre. And if anybody said, you know, who's your one of your desert island picks, she'd almost always make one of the lists for sure. But as you continue to dig, you know, there's other people, different layers of the onion. And so for artists who sort of paved the way and are no longer with us, you know, I really do love Julie London. I really love Irene Krall. I think Irene Krall is a stunning vocalist and musician and didn't get her due. I also, you know, for artists who I'm fortunate to have seen Nancy Wilson perform live before, which was truly a gift. But for artists who are living, you know, I am a huge Kurt Elling fan, Kate McGarry. I love a jazz singer in Australia named Kristen Berardi. She's tremendous. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, other genres. I'm a really big Emily King fan. I would definitely be excited to meet Sarah Bareilles in person. I love Beyonce. And, you know, so there are like different layers of the onion, and I'm a human. And so there's other people who are like, obviously most people love. And so of course I love them too. But that doesn't mean, you know, that just cause I love me some Stevie doesn't mean I'm not a jazz head.
Right, of course. Well, I mean, and that's the beauty of it, that it's not necessarily have to be pigeonholed into one particular thing. Now, when you talk with someone, I'm just interested as a fan of an Ella Fitzgerald. I saw recently the latest documentary that came out for her this year. A really great documentary. And they really do a really good analysis of breaking down, like, when she's kind of going on these scat tangents, how she makes all these allusions to so many popular songs and different genres of songs and things. But Ella has such a breadth of work, you know, starting with the Tisker the Tasket all the way to her last Grammy winning album, like 1989. So like what Ella, I guess, period would you say is the one that you like the best?
Oh man. I've never been asked that question. That's really hard to answer. I feel like there was a sweetness to Ella's voice when she was kind of like at the height of her career, you know, when she was recording with, I mean, she recorded with Basie forever, but the record that I fell in love with her music and jazz ultimately was the record that Count Basie and Ella made together called Ella and Basie.
Oh yeah. With Honeysuckle Rose and all
that. Yeah. And Sunny Side of the Street and all those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that one, I have a soft spot in my heart for that, like kind of that time period of Ella's music. But then when you listen to her later stuff, like some of the duo recordings with Joe Pass and Oscar Peterson, she sounds so confident and like she's taking so many risks in such a beautiful way. And there's no preciousness, if that makes sense. Like she just is kind of like an older woman who knows that she can do it. So like, let's take some risks. And her voice wasn't, you know, the most, I don't know, flexible or the most pure, but in the same way that like Joni Mitchell's later stuff is some of the most heavy, expressive, beautiful music of her career. You know, sometimes you just, it's less about the beauty and more about the expression and the freedom.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely see that transition with Ella, and I like some of her later stuff as well during that time. But, you know, everyone kind of falls in love with what sounds the best to their ear and what they like. Yeah. And so, but I mean, to go from, you know, novelty into later, you know, impressive improvisation, and then later into the songbooks, which I think were a lot of people remember those from her. It's just interesting. I think everybody hears it differently, but there is no bad Ella, I'll say that.
There's no bad Ella. That's a good way to put it.
Now, speaking of stuff, so now you did a live album at the Jazz Bakery, which I don't think it's anymore, but I love that place. I miss it. And so how's performing live for you versus your in-studio kind of experience?
That's another great question. Yeah, I mean, I think I was talking with a musician friend about this recently, you know, because we're all at this time stuck at home. And when you're recording in the studio, it's such a different experience from recording or performing live. And then when you're recording at home, it's a totally different experience. And we kind of like rate it as performing live under perfect conditions as sort of like the unattainable goal of like perfection and transcendence. And then recording in the studio, there's just something about realizing that what you're doing in that moment is going to exist forever. And that if you take a risk that doesn't pan out, you have to start over and you're wasting people's time. You know, it's like money, like time is money when you're in the recording studio. So I think that most musicians would agree that when you're recording live, there's just more response, you know, there's more that you're willing to throw out onto the table and just kind of throw against the wall and see what sticks. There's a different thing that you're chasing when you're performing live. There's this like desire to tap into something that's bigger than yourself and this hope that you're able to do so in an attempt to like, yeah, tap into that authenticity and express something that that everyone can identify with, you know, this idea of humanity and expressing humanity through art. And it's just challenging to do that with the time constrictions and the focus and you know, the like listening through headphones and being in a simulated room by yourself. It's just so different from being in front of an audience. And then, yeah, when you're doing that same stuff, but like at home without a professional engineer. You hear the ice cream truck coming by. It's just such a totally different experience. But as musicians, you kind of have to be ready for it all. So I'm at the point now where in the studio, I'm not thrown by it. I feel like I still really love it and enjoy what I'm doing. But it definitely is not, you know, I think most musicians thrive in the live setting more than definitely more than recorded.
Yeah. And I love having the juxtaposition of the studio album and the live album of the same songs to kind of hear how it is live too. Mm-hmm. Now you're no stranger, even though you're a solo artist working with people like your group Sage, you did do two albums with Josh Nelson duo and then Dreamin' Blue. So what was that kind of working together project like?
Yeah, you know, it was such an interesting process to sort of grow up musically with another artist. Josh Nelson and I both were fairly young when we came to each other and had the opportunity to grow up like with and alongside one another, which is something that very few musicians have the opportunity to do. And the cool thing about that is that when we were younger, you know, we kind of like developed similar sensibilities and really beautiful instincts in response to one another. And then it only made sense after having worked together for however long, 12 years, 10 years, that we wanted to make a record kind of in celebration of that. And so that's ultimately what Dreamin' the Blue was this album of just kind of like compositions that Josh and I had written together in celebration of that kind of connection that you can achieve with another person, which I've probably at least to that degree have never experienced before, you know, like that kind of instinct and anticipation of another person's like musical instincts, I guess. I've performed live with other people in ways that are really thrilling and exciting. Like the times that I've performed with Fred Hirsch have been some of the more riveting experiences of my life. But to be able to anticipate what someone is going to do and what someone is feeling is just a totally different experience. So that's kind of what Dreamin' the Blue was.
Oh, yeah. Well, jazz is definitely known for improvisation and keeping you on your toes. So you're in good company there. So you did mention Kurt Elling is someone that you love, and you've done some collaborations with him and other luminaries. You mentioned Fred Hirsch as well, Billy Childs, Larry Golding. So do you have any, I don't know, like an interesting story or something memorable from working with any of those type of people that you might want to share?
Yeah, I mean, performing with Fred is just an exercise in being in the moment. You know, he's so in the moment. We worked out a list of songs that we both knew that we both liked. And I told him the keys that I typically perform them in. And that was all that was decided before we walked out on stage. And so I had no idea what song he wanted to start with or what song we were ending with. And a lot of times he would just start an intro. And I had to kind of like, I think it's this song, you know, and we would go through it. And there wasn't a decision about like who was going to take what solo or, you know, what key he would modulate to for his solo and whether or not he'd modulate back or if we'd end in that key. So that was really, really exciting. And that was one of the first, times I've ever performed truly improvised music. There was even a song in that performance where, you know, I had brought in a poem that I thought we could use as a verse to one of the songs. And Fred improvised, we improvised the melody and the chords and everything. And so that was a new experience for me, to say the least, but a really like a gift, totally a gift. And there's a song on Spotify that, man, actually it's the song where we improvised the verse to Darn That Dream. And that's on Spotify because Fred does that. Sometimes he'll just record a show and 6 months later, he's like, hey, I think we should release this. It's like, what? You were recording? So that was fun with Fred. And performing with Billy Childs, you know, Billy's known as one of the great composers of our genre and beyond. And so anytime I've ever performed with Billy, I've always wanted to do his music justice, which just takes when someone writes something in like, you know, 13-8 with two bars of three and a bar of six and then two bars of five, you know, it's like, God, Billy's music is takes concentration, but it doesn't sound like it, which is such a gift. And so anytime I've ever performed with Billy, I've always wanted to make sure that I memorized by the time I walk it on stage so that I can breathe, you know, I can hang without thinking. But it's always a gift to play with him. And Kurt Elling, you know, Kurt is just, anyone who knows him and is sort of in his circle of friends knows that Kurt is just like sort of a mensch, you know, he's an incredible person with a lot to give. And I've been fortunate in my life to have Kurt as sort of a, I wouldn't call him a mentor because it's a different relationship from that. I would say maybe he's an advocate. He's always been somebody that kind of understands what I've tried to do artistically and where I'm headed artistically and just wants to make sure that I'm on the right path and wants to give as much as possible to make sure that I get there, you know, which is not something that many people get to experience in their lives. And so I recognize that, you know, I'm really fortunate to have had him in my corner in the same way that I've been fortunate to have John Clayton in my corner as well. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the beauty of this art form, you know, is that there's just so many artists who are willing to share and kind of give. And I've just been one of many who are fortunate to experience that for sure.
I think that's great. I think that's great that people are willing to give back and to share because that's how we keep the magic and the music going. And so I wanted to talk about one more collaboration now. Previously, in 2010, you recorded Where Time Stands Still with the German band TrioSense. And so you have quite a big European following, but how's the European energy kind of working on a record with that type of band versus other energies and people that you work with?
You know, I think I can't speak for like German European bands as a whole. I would just say that in my time with that particular band, the main, I guess not the main, the guy who actually runs the group, Bernhard Schuller, is a jazz musician, but has a deep classical roots. And so for Bernhard, he really thrived on more compositions and kind of like structure. And, you know, fortunately, I was given a pass at least to like emotionally be improvisational with the song and kind of play with diction and phrasing and a few things. But I think for the most part, he had a pretty strong vision for what he wanted. And then, of course, you know, would improvise over the chord changes in the middle of the song. But I think they were pretty, it was pretty through composed in those performances. which, you know, is not good or bad. There's a lot of bands that thrive in those things. It's just, you know, a huge different from the perspective and the kind of value system of a musician like Fred Hirsch, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I love about it, is that when I talk to people on the podcast, you realize that everyone's process and how they do it is different. We may all end up with a similar result, but how they actually did it is all quite different and fascinating to me. So start to wrap up, Sarah, so enjoyable to talk to you. I always ask two rapid fire questions to all of the guests.
Sure.
One of them is, what advice would you give a kid starting out in music today?
I would say, let yourself love what you love. You know, I know that at least when I was in high school and in college, and I still see this today, that like there's a desire to fit in. And once you get into the world, you realize that there's nothing more beautiful to celebrate in humanity than your own individuality. And so, you know, it's about finding pride in the things that you love and not feeling obligated to love things because other people love them. And so somebody might love Miles Davis Bitches Brew, but Miles Davis Bitches Brew isn't your favorite record. You actually really love, you know, Sketches of Spain, or Miles Davis isn't your cup of tea. You know, I think it's okay to not go with the flow all the time, would be my, but like to chase what you love. That would be my advice to young people.
That's great advice. And then what do you want your musical legacy to be? And it may be still too early in your career to say, but when it's all said and done, like if you could be remembered for one thing, what would that be?
World domination. No.
Nice.
I mean, I think I have really similar artistic goals as every other artist in the world. I'd love to just be out doing as much as possible. But I think in terms of like values, my hope is that people find healing in the music that I put out in the world. That would be my hope.
I think that's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment. And we can definitely hear that on the latest recordings from Sage. Hopefully there'll be more stuff from them and more stuff from your solo work. Sarah Gazarlik, what is next for you?
Next is, you know, just continuing to work with Sage, heading to the Grammys. Hopefully releasing our first record, and then, you know, at some point, of course, releasing another of my own solo records, but just kind of being out in the world and continuing to make music.
Excellent. Well, all of your music is out on the streaming platform. Sage, you can definitely check out Desert Song, which is nominated for a Grammy, and their other song is currently on Spotify and all streaming platforms, as well as Sarah Gazarlik's catalog. Sarah, thank you so much for being on. We had so much fun chatting with you, and we'll circle back to you when it's all out so you have the links to everything and we can stay connected.
Continue
following your career.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. We'll talk soon. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thanks again for listening to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach and sponsored by California Soul Music Record Label. I had so much fun talking with jazz vocalist Sarah Gazarlik about her Grammy nomination with her female supergroup Sage and their song Desert Song. You can check it out on streaming platforms now. It's amazing. I would also like to thank our engineer Tim Hall and 1192 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording today. If you like what you hear and you want to hear more, you can check us out online at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves or anchor.fm/deepergrooves. Until then, stay safe, be healthy. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.